This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Daniel Paris, host of the New Books in Finance channel of the New Books Network. I'm very pleased today to have as my guest Dr. Hassan Malik, author of Bankers and Bolsheviks, International Finance and the Russian Revolution, a new book that just came out from Princeton University Press. Dr. Malik, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Daniel. It's a real privilege.
You know, your book, for someone who is interested both in Russian history and in finance, I found your book particularly interesting because the intersection usually is, there's not much of an intersection in the minds of most people. But as you have pointed out in your book, a very detailed account, there's actually a lot of material of the finance side of the two decades before the Russian Revolution, and then the Great Default, which we'll get to, kind of the denouement of the Bolsheviks in January 2018, that's you know, generally not part of the narrative, but is you know, an important part of the story. How did you come upon this as a topic? And you know, it's rare for many dissertations to be, frankly, substantially new. This I enjoyed reading because it even though I have a PhD in Russian history, a lot of what you wrote was new.
Well, that's great to hear. Yeah, so basically the topic and the subject came to me as I was working in finance in Moscow. I had been working on Wall Street for a few years out of college, covering the US and European markets, but had learned Russian in college, had an interest in the country, and had moved out to work for the largest bank in Moscow at the time. And really living in central Moscow in those days was fascinating for me because I was walking around the old town, and it was while you could see the hammers and sickles and all the signs of the communist past, and certainly all the signs of post-communist Russia, many of the buildings pre-revolution in central Moscow had to do with the pre-revolutionary financial past. In fact, the Lubyanka, which was a stone's throw from my flat in my office and was infamous as the headquarters of the KGB, was in its first guise an insurance company. And so that set me on this path of trying to understand what was happening before the revolution from a financial angle. And the more I read about it, the more I was struck by how little had been written about this Russian financial boom and bust, even in global financial history, where we hear about the German hyperinflation, where we hear about the Dutch tulip mania. For some reason, Russia had been kind of overlooked in all of this.
I agree. And, you know, the assumption in the ideological assumption, and I have to say, after 20 years after leaving academia, the kind of ideological bias in academia is fairly anti-financial, anti-capitalist. It is what it is. I can see that clearly now. I might not have seen it at the time, but this was not a topic that would have been viewed with, you know, positively, I think, by many people heading in. the kind of the finance side of Russia before the revolution and during the revolution. So I appreciate you picking up that topic. You do in the first part of the book deal with some of the material that I did have to encounter, but you take a fresh take on it. So there are debates in Russian history, as everyone is taught who goes through that, about Sergei Vita and what he did not do or did do, and how modernizing it was or was not. And then, of course, the famous debate on the eve of the Russian Revolution concerning the economic condition of Russia and the Hamsun debate. So can you take us a little bit through those kind of finance debates and the finance reality of the czarist regime's, I wouldn't call it dependence, but relationship with the French markets, lack of relationship with some of the other markets, and how they fit into your kind of fresh take from this perspective on Sergei Vita and also on the Russia's condition in the years between the Russian Revolution of 1905 and the outbreak of World War I.
Sure. So the way Vita is talked about in the literature is as really a modernizing, industrializing force in pre-revolutionary Russian society. So just a bit of background for the audience. He was very much a technocrat, came up through the railroad bureaucracy in Russia, and was eventually put in the post of finance minister, and really launched a program of tapping the international bond market and using the proceeds to build up Russia's foreign exchange reserves, ultimately bringing Russia to the gold standard, and also using foreign capital to help drive Russian industrialization, particularly through the railroad sector and heavy industry. And what I talk about in the first chapter of the book is the predecessors and the legacy that Vita drew on from his predecessors, and make the point that basically he was in some ways actually quite a latecomer to the policy that I've just sketched out, and somewhat of a late convert. And so one point I make is that this is a story that's very much about Vita, but also goes well beyond him. Another point that you mentioned, and I think is crucial here, and I think this again comes from having looked at companies and sovereign debt issuers as countries, and thinking about sources of funding and diversity of funding. And of course, I was writing this through various gyrations of financial markets. And I think this is something that goes unremarked in some of the literature on Vita's period, which is that he became very dependent on the French capital market. And France at the time had one of the highest savings rates in Europe. And so in many ways, there was a lot of wisdom to Vita's strategy. And there was a diplomatic component of this borrowing program in the sense that Russia and Germany had a hot and cold rivalry, and the French and the Germans were not were very much adversaries. And so there was a diplomatic component to that. But I think one of the lost opportunities of this time, and this is something that I go into in the second chapter as well, is Vita, in a sense, for all his wisdom in terms of seeing the opportunities internationally and using international money markets to finance Russian industrialization, also missed the shift in global finance that was happening from Paris to London and ultimately to New York. And this was an oversight that ended up costing Russia quite dearly later on, when they needed Anglo-American capital and found it harder to get because they just hadn't built that brand name within the British and New York markets.
This is one of the things that I found so interesting in your work was that, in the modern age, we think of finance as algorithmic, and to some extent it is. Everything's kind of computer-driven. But the age of the personal banker and the personal relationship really comes out in here. The French were – or the Russians were very comfortable dealing with the French. Clearly – you know, the English were less so, and then the Americans were almost off the radar screen for them. And Morgan kind of feels the same way about the Russians. He's somewhat wary, but that – it was a conscious cultural subjective choice. It wasn't a system in equilibrium, which is the standard model that we all operate under for finance now. This was a personal relationship. It certainly wasn't in a system of personal relationships, and certainly not an equilibrium system. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been entirely dependent or mostly using French capital.
That's absolutely right. I mean, this is very much a human story. And I guess from the academic angle, one of the things that I was trying to do was bring a human dimension to a very extensive literature in the social sciences on what drives capital flows, what drives investors to invest in developing countries. So there's been a lot of economics and political science literature on this. But what I find missing in a lot of that work is precisely this human dimension, that ultimately these were humans making decisions and humans deciding which factors to weight more and less. And frankly, that's something that even if you look at emerging markets today, whether it's Brazil or Turkey or India, I think it's still something that's very much present with us today in the age of AI and computers and finance.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I would be even more direct, and this may not be relevant to all of sort of the academic history listeners, but even if you look at the relationship between Jay Powell and Donald Trump, and what happened, this is being recorded in late December, but there was an interview yesterday, the day before, in the markets by one of the New York Fed governor, Williams, and markets, for all of the computers that are supposed to be keeping score, the markets are still substantially driven by people, personalities, and comments. And it's not just emerging markets. I think it is even the developed markets are surprisingly less machine-like, less systems in equilibrium, the way they are described by macroeconomists, than not necessarily living, breathing creatures, but substantially driven by these personal factors. And seeing it described about a market 100 years ago made me think how much it's still actually that way today.
Absolutely.
So in addition to the kind of getting around Sergei Vita and the French dependence and slowly building up the relationship with the British and the Americans, there's also a lot of material early on the book, part of some well-worn, but important articulated debates about the state of Russia's economy, how even or uneven it was. And, you're chiming in with your views. And this leads into what broadly, very broadly speaking, the Hampson debate, that is, would Russia have gotten through without World War I or not? You know, how robust and trustworthy was the Russian economy in the decade and a half before World War I? And, you know, you're bringing, at least for me, a fresh take on that.
Right. So I think basically what the book sketches out is you have this very extreme crisis where Russia is pushed to the wall financially and militarily in 1904, 1905. And then you have kind of an injection of foreign capital, which helps stabilize the regime. And you see a remarkable decade-long rally in Russian asset prices in the financial markets, as well as in the real economy. But by the eve of the war, you start to see, and this is, you know, when I'm reading the bankers' reports, when I'm reading diplomatic cables at the time, and when you're looking at some of the macro numbers, you're starting to see strains of a financial crisis brewing in Russia. And it's exactly around that same time that you see an injection of essentially fiscal stimulus through a ramp up in defense spending from the Russian state that actually helps stave off this potentially disastrous financial crisis. And I think that's where it touches on some of the old, more traditional debate about Russian politics and the timing of the actual revolutionary outbreak.
You know, there's parallels in the United States with the Depression and what brings us out of the Depression, World War II. You know, there's a softer version of this in regard to Russia, and that the spending of World War I, does it buy Russia time, or is Russia more fragile, less fragile as a result of the war? And, would Russia have made it as a bourgeois society, after the first revolution? Unlikely, but would they have made it had it not been for the war? And And, you know, that a lot of graduate students spend a lot of time arguing about that. I don't know how important that is at this point in time, but that is kind of that standard debate, you know, was the Russian Revolution an aberration or was it inevitable? And you're you know, kind of filling in some of the space around the financial elements of that, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the basic point that I make is that the war bought, and that's kind of a theme through a couple of these inflection points, is that finance and the economic dimension shows that the regime bought some time in the immediate sense, but at some significant cost down the road.
So let's kind of move on to World War One, and you know, the lead up to the revolution. And here, some of the story shifts to, at least from my perspective, fascinating, the perceptions by the Western bankers, French, English, and American, as to, you know, in retrospect, we see World War One, Barbara Tuchman like, as kind of a total wipeout, and the people involved didn't see it coming at all. And, you know, in August 1914, everything's fine. And just a few years later, Europe's in a rubble heap. And the Russians and the Western financiers dealing with the Russians pretty much fit into that narrative. Surprisingly, up to even January 1918, that is, they are oblivious to the risks of this war to a, you know, surprising degree. Unless, you know, did you agree with that summary version, or is that not, is that stating it too strongly?
No, I think that's very fair. And I think where I come from this is really with a very sympathetic and empathetic view to these people, because when I started the research for this book, it was really right after the 08 financial blow up in more recent times, and understand, and I think I had a sensitivity to the difficulty that investors face when they're trying to read the tea leaves of not only global financial markets but also all the geopolitics that play into this. And what was interesting to me was that this wasn't in some ways the war, as well as the default, were not, and as well as the Bolshevik Revolution, were not bolts from the blue. These were not completely unknowns, but this was really a failure of some financiers to accurately or properly weigh the different pieces of information they were getting. So there were, you know, one of the figures that I point to is Cecil Spring Rice, who was a rising star in the British Foreign Office, who had actually raised some of the concerns about, you know, the willingness of successor regimes to the Tsar to uphold their financial obligations and ultimately to repudiate. And actually, I saw some of this stuff in banking archives in London, in particular. But the bankers, confronted with this huge amount of different, you know, readings of the market and readings of the political situation, just didn't weigh that as much as they may have wanted to in retrospect.
And, you know, they're not alone. Very few people, you know, wars and revolutions are frequent in Europe, but people didn't, they're hard to see at the time. And World War One, and then the Tsarist regime failing. First, and again, there, you know, there was some, as you point out, and many pointed out, thought that, you know, the spring of 1917 is a good thing, and everything was going to work out nicely. That was a positive step, that the provisional government would be better rather than worse. But people just don't see the risk associated with these events at the time. And again, you have a number of these are kind of the anecdotal level, but interesting, of a number of Western institutions getting involved with, including National City, getting involved with Russia during the war and during the revolution, including the revolution of the Spring Revolution and bringing in the provisional government, but, you know, opening up branches and having plans to expand their operations in 1917 in Russia from an American bank. That anecdote is wonderful. I don't know if you want to, you know, provide some color around that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was one of my favorite things to research, actually. National City is a direct forerunner to today's Citigroup, and they had expanded. They were in the process of expanding internationally. They'd made big moves in Latin America, were probing the Asian markets. But Russia was really one of the pillars of their international expansion, and they'd sent a sort of jack-of-all-trades, veteran of emerging markets banker to Russia to study the scene, to meet with the policymakers, with industrialists, with fellow bankers. And he basically came to the conclusion in late 1916 that the bank should be opening in St. Petersburg. They do that in early 1917. And really, even after the Tsar abdicates in what was known as the February Revolution, when he's set aside and liberal forces try and move Russia towards a constitutional regime, there was a lot of hope. And it strikes a chord with both things that I've seen in Russia more recently, as well as in other markets. So one of the themes that you've just sort of touched on is this notion that anything that was moving away from czarism was seen as progress at the time. And if you look at what journalists and commentators were writing about Russia, many of the tropes that you see talked about Russia today, the bureaucracy, corruption, police state, lack of democracy, many of these things that have been ascribed either to Putin or to the Soviet legacy were actually being ascribed to czarism. And so at the time, there's this great hope amongst many observers, including bankers, that any change from czarism would be a positive thing. And again, this was something that I was reading about and researching at the time of the Egyptian Revolution and the Arab Spring, which in 2010, 2011 held out a lot of hope. And many of these hopes were then later dashed in Egypt and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And then even more surprisingly is this notion that as the Bolsheviks moved to the fore, and people just cannot conceive of the notion that this could go really south for their bonds. And do you want to describe a little bit the emergence of the Bolsheviks, who are out of power until the moment they're in power, but their emerging sense from Lenin's writings on the topic to more bureaucratic observations as to what their emerging view of a modern government's finance would be. I think it's particularly finance, an undertreated topic about how the Bolsheviks would handle the practicalities of government. And then it's one thing to be an ideologue and to say, we don't care about this whole system. It's going away. It's another thing to say, how are we going to pay the workers? That type of thing. And what do we do about all this paperwork that we inherit from the provisional government?
Sure. So one of the things that I was really found interesting when I was reading and researching on the book was looking at the Bolshevik writings and speeches and positions on the whole question of the debt from really a fresh angle. Because I, like many people, had almost been kind of imbibed with this notion that, of course, the Bolsheviks are going to default. And this also this sense, given what happened in the Soviet Union later, that they were just hapless and didn't understand financial markets. And this was just a knee-jerk ideological response. Whereas actually, I think if one looks at some of Lenin's writings, around the time of the revolution on questions of finance, he was, in my mind, a very perceptive and astute student of financial markets and public finance in particular. And he understood, and one of the points I make in even earlier chapters is that he was using finance as a weapon. And just as there were fighting in the streets, just as there were fighting in the debating chambers and in the newspapers, the Bolsheviks were also fighting against the regime in financial markets. And so a lot of their positions were deliberate attempts to discredit the provisional government, which had replaced the Tsarist government, from a financial market standpoint, to reduce its credibility. And he was constantly critiquing them. So that was sort of the first stage prior to assuming power. And then you know,
but that stage is important because, again, we have one of the risks of being a historian or a bad historian is that you just assume the outcome was inevitable.
Right.
And what that shows is that the outcome, say, repudiation of debts, a particular path, was not inevitable, that Lenin and the others were, you know, hey, you know, here are the options. Yeah, sure, we have a preference, but we don't know how this is going to work out either. And we're kind of working through these options. And that I thought was fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. So this was, you're absolutely right. There were debates within the party, within the high party leadership. And what ends up happening is they take power through what was essentially a coup d'etat, as their own party historians termed it in Russian. And you have this odd situation where they almost didn't really expect to have succeeded. And you have the first couple of months of the Bolshevik government, if you read the, as I did, the minutes of essentially the Bolshevik cabinet, they're confronted with just the basic mechanics. And I think you sort of alluded to this, of running one of the largest countries on earth, making payments to the employees, trying to get the central bank and just
issue
the payment
money
system.
Yeah,
exactly. Just the basic mechanics of running administration of such a large entity.
You have an anecdote about the central banker simply saying when the Bolsheviks needed simply some cash, and I forget to pay some bill, and the central banker simply said no, and I forget exactly how that played out, but there was a back and forth, if you recall, that was, you know, stunning if you think about how modern governments work. And again, here was an individual just standing, saying no.
Exactly. And you had the first crisis that the Bolsheviks were dealing with was that the post and telegraph workers went on strike. The central bank or the banking, the finance ministry and the central bank's clerks went on strike. And so you have these highly, radical and very violent people that have taken power of government, but are basically pleading with minor government functionaries to come back to work so that they can literally start the trains running again. And, eventually through a mix of coercion and carrot and stick tactics, they are ultimately able to seize the reins of state. And then you have this real question of what happens with the foreign loans, with the domestic and the foreign loans. And this is where I think the pragmatic element comes into play, which is often just sort of dismissed in discussions of the Bolsheviks just having been ideologically predisposed to default. And what I basically think through is the counterfactual of what would have happened. Well, there's two aspects. One is, what did default do for the Bolsheviks pragmatically? And I think there's a very clear benefit to the Bolsheviks in the sense of winning support from the peasantry, which of course was not the natural ally of the Bolsheviks. The Bolsheviks were,
the urban party.
Urban party, a lot of intelligentsia. They're not really a peasant party, and you have them essentially say that, "Hey, we're gonna rip up all these debt contracts that peasants owe to landowners and the government," which is obviously a way of which has the benefit of winning them some sympathy from the peasantry. But then the other question for me was the counterfactual, which is that, as you know, as a historian of Russia, the Bolshevik Revolution, that coup in October, was a very closely run thing. I mean, there was a point where Lenin is stopped on the way to meet the rest of the Bolshevik high command, and he's mistaken, he's disguised as a drunk. And had he been stopped at that point and arrested, it's a big question of whether or not that coup would have succeeded. And then, which begs the question of what would have happened had it been an alternative government that would have seen out the end of 1917. And that's where my contention is that you would have probably seen a massive default anyway. It may not have been a total repudiation the way the Bolsheviks did. And I think that's one of the distinctions they had versus other potential regimes. But you would have still seen a massive default because by late 1917, even though you'd seen a wartime boom in the early part of the war because of war spending, like you saw in many places, by the end, the real economy was really suffering in Russia. And there was a statistic where I think the the average housewife in St. Petersburg was spending something like 40 hours a week just waiting in line for basic necessities. And so that's where I think that the counterfactual is that, you know, from a pragmatic standpoint, any regime would have probably had to default.
So there's some nice little ideological tidbits there as the debate is going on. That is the there's a perception that it is mostly French money, and so why should we repay these French bonds to the French bourgeoisie? But correct me whether there was any domestic subscription to these loans. That there's some small portion, if I'm not mistaken, of the repudiation of the debt would have been to domestic savers, albeit a small portion. But there was a risk associated with that. It's not just the borrowers, but also the savers in Russia. The borrowers were going to be helped, but the savers were going to be punished in Russia by the repudiation of the state debt. Is that not correct?
That's absolutely right. And one of actually the interesting things about these bonds is that these bonds would basically be illegal for U.S. citizens today to hold because they were bearer bonds. And these were essentially pieces of paper with no central registry of who owned them. So literally the way you would get paid is you take this piece of paper to the appropriate bank in London or Paris or Berlin. It didn't really matter. And you would be paid in the local currency of that country, in a gold equivalent amount.
It's a pure bearer bond. It doesn't matter who's bringing it in.
Exactly. So we actually have no idea of what the exact split geographically or otherwise was in terms of the holdings of these bonds. But it's totally it's very, very likely that there were a substantial number of Russian holders of this paper. And the Bolsheviks basically, they did a couple of things. The first is that they tried to play a game with these guys, with the Russian holders, and said, look, what we want to do is we just want to register who owns these bonds and other financial assets so that we can pay you and we make sure that you're not you're not cheated, which obviously has the benefit of telling them exactly where where the holdings lie.
You're
so
right.
That they can expropriate. And the other thing that they did was they made a small provision, which they said that any, and I forget what the exact amount was, but it was anyone who holds under a certain amount is going to be paid. But of course, with the wartime inflation,
it didn't matter.
That was essentially a tax on everyone.
Right. So there's this drama. But again, what I like about it is the absence of your history is the absence of inevitability, though you say they probably would have defaulted counterfactually. But the fact there was a process, it wasn't just, hey, we're Bolsheviks, we reject your system, we're defaulting. There was a process by which they thought about it, pros and cons, back and forth and degree, which, again, is history as it should be, not just backward looking, hey, the Bolsheviks, they're going to default. And the same logic, I think, applies to the actual mechanism of default between November 1917 and through January, February of 1918, it's not just there's a Sovnarkom resolution, but there's a lot more to it, and a little bit of high drama, I suppose. Do you want to kind of highlight the highlights of that?
Right. So there was this kind of back and forth in terms of, as you've alluded, within the party, within the hierarchy, debates of should we nationalize, should we expropriate financial assets, should we create exceptions, should we, and as you mentioned, the Sovnarkom, essentially the Bolshevik cabinet, is going through these discussions, and the strikes that they're being confronted with, and the practicalities of trying to take over the machinery of state start pushing them to and fro. And there's of course in the financial markets, there's all sorts of rumor mongering about what is actually happening. Some people are saying, it's default is inevitable. It's going to happen. Other people are saying there's no way this could happen because this would be complete financial suicide and it makes no sense. With a strong parallel to arguments about how World War I breaking out was unlikely because it would have been such a catastrophe that it wouldn't have made rational sense. And there was a very famous Russian Polish industrialist who made an argument saying that essentially there's no likelihood of war breaking out because it's financial suicide.
Right.
And ultimately what ends up happening in the first quarter of 1918 is, you see a series of bodies that issue decrees, and ultimately the default is declared. And what is interesting is that even past that moment of default, you have financial market participants just not believing it.
And opening branches in Vologda and Vladivostok and St. Petersburg and Moscow in beautiful buildings.
Exactly. And not only beautiful buildings, but in the case of National City in Moscow, it was in the very same hotel, the National Hotel, which is one of the nicest in Moscow, where the Bolsheviks themselves, Lenin and Stalin included, had pitched up after taking over the government. So you literally, it's a hotel with a very small lobby. You would have literally had the American bankers and Lenin and the other Bolsheviks sort of brushing past each other as they went in and out.
An outstanding moment. I see a movie script about that very point. That was actually one of the great, towards the end of the book, and the default is playing out, but that's really one of the great moments of the book is the description of those bank branches being opened and the implications. And you're sitting there and you're just kind of slapping your forehead and saying, wow, there are people here on very different wavelengths, and yet they're right next to each other at the same time and same place. So that was really quite a stunning end to the book. I as a historian, I have to be cautious about presentism and, you know, reading too much from the past and a crude historicism and assuming everything never changes and, you know, all the answers lie in the past. But as a finance person and a historian, I can't help but think about your book and recommend it to others on the basis of current circumstances that, you know, I do see frailty. I'm not a bear market person. I'm not short in a short meaning as for listeners is a type of investment where you assume things are going to be going down. I am not that at all. But there is in modern finance an assumption that risk has been managed through governments, right, that there are mechanisms to prevent collapse, that economic cyclicality has been substantially dampened, that the basis for stable economic and financial growth is well entrenched globally. Yes, periodically Argentina or some other country is going to have difficulties, but the basic system is very stable. And that's an assumption that many market participants without historical backgrounds bring to the table and they go about their business. Nassim Taleb is not one of them, and right, I am not one of them as well. I'm well aware of historical risks, and I think that your book, Dr. Malik, Bankers and Bolsheviks, International Finance and the Russian Revolution, is in effect very timely, not because I think any of these, you know, the exact risks are going to play out exactly the way they did 100 years ago, but that investors and participants in the capital markets need to understand that the unexpected can happen.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think you bring up a very good point in terms of the unexpected and these big step changes. And one of the themes that I think is very important out of this book is the degree to which countries can completely also break away from, in a sense, their own historical typification by the market. So what I mean by that is Russia at the time, today we think of Russia as an emerging market. It's one of the BRICS. It's a developing economy. It's, you know, it's finding its way in the global economy as in, on the development ladder. But at the time, Russia was seen as a European great power. It had some of the largest gold reserves in the world. It wasn't seen in the same category as, say, an Egypt or an Argentina or a Brazil. Many of these countries having defaulted on many occasions. And you see that actually in the financial market data. After the Bolsheviks default, the risk premia or the sort of the market's indicators of what of stress for Russian assets had spiked. They showed alarm, but they didn't show alarm to the same degree that the market had shown for Greece and Argentina. Whereas, of course, the story ends much worse for investors in Russian assets. And one of the things that the bankers, to their credit, I mean, this is again one of the things that I'm trying to think of the bankers in their own terms. They were looking at history and they were saying, hang on, Russia is right now saying they're not going to default, but historically Russia has gone way out of its way to stay current on its debts. In fact, one of the bankers that I talk about referred to the Crimean War when Russia was fighting with many Western countries, but actually continued to pay Western bondholders in full in gold-backed rubles on time. And that commentator said, look, let's look at the history. Russia actually, paid. Citizen.
Yeah.
And to your point, it's that thing that, just as much as it's not important to be presentist when we're thinking about history and applying it to financial markets, it's also important, I think, not to use history mechanically. And I think, us historians, sometimes we cringe when we see some of these crude rules laid out about, well, when a certain country breaches a certain debt to GDP number, then there's going to be a financial collapse. It's often much more murky and not so straightforward deriving lessons from history and applying them to the modern world.
Indeed. And that I think that your book does a good job to, it can be read, your book, closely. It can also be skimmed. I think for certain maybe financial market participants who can be helpfully reminded of what you said about, the careful nuances of a risk of collapse or a borrower's capability. Or well read by the historian of Russia trying to fill in some blank spaces. But thank you very much, Dr. Malik. It is a very interesting book. Again, that's Bankers and Bolsheviks, International Finance and the Russian Revolution. It is available through all of the standard outlets. And I thank you for taking the time to provide us some with some highlights from the book.
Thank you, Daniel. It was a real pleasure.